Welcome back, Hemingway listeners, to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we do excellent things in our brains. Should I tell you what I just did? No, it's too weird. It's 2 in the morning, and I went outside onto the balcony because it's raining, and it was really peaceful. And it's like the sound of the water trickling down from the gutters, and like the rain falling and swishing the tree leaves all around, and it was like sort of the distant sound of frogs and insects making frog and insect noises. And I was listening to it and just enjoying it, and I thought, I need to pee. This sound's making me need to pee, but I'm enjoying this peaceful serenity. And I was just like, there's no cars. Like, always there's just cars going past my house. Not like, yeah, well, kind of, you know, across outside my fence sort of thing. But there's just always the sound of cars. And there wasn't. And I just couldn't hear any. Just frogs and rain. And so I just peed there. I just peed off my balcony into the garden. And why am I telling you this? Why would I? I don't know. Maybe because I've been socially isolating for 1 month now and I'm going crazy. That could be why I just told you about a nice pee that I had just before. Or maybe it was just a really serene and peaceful pee. And I just felt like sharing such a time in my life with potentially thousands of people who might listen to this episode. Now I'm wondering if I should start this episode again and not tell the peeing off the balcony story, but you know what, I'm going to roll the dice on this one and just leave it in. Just see what happens. Because I am bored. I'm bored today. I'm just restless, you know? God damn. Anyway, that's enough about my social isolation diary. We're all experiencing the same stuff, so you don't need to hear me going on and on about it. Tonight's episode of the podcast isn't brought to you by any kind of food or beverage. I'm just going it alone this time. No need for a beverage. Didn't have a beer today, which is good. So now I know I'm not an alcoholic. Phew. Let's get stuck into some podcasting. I mean, Madame Bovary, part 1, chapter 7. Is there some potential for Charles not to be a total drag? Our treat said, I'm not 100% convinced that Charles is a total drag, although I think they are certainly a mismatched pair. We're told that Charles's conversation was as flat as a sidewalk. I shared an office with someone whose conversation was very dull to me, mind-numbing, actually, and describing it as flat as a sidewalk would be a compliment in my eyes, but I know other people who loved it and flourished talking to this person. Maybe not surprisingly, these people's conversation was also exceedingly boring from my perspective. It doesn't make that person a complete dullard. It just means that I personally don't relish their conversation style. I feel that. Yeah. I am that sometimes. Sometimes when I go like, oh, I should have a good conversation with this person, and I try to have a conversation, and I just can't say anything remotely interesting. Yeah. But it's like, because you overthink it, you know. Once you think like, oh, let's have a really good conversation. And then as soon as you've thought that, you've screwed it up. Whereas when I'm just in chatterbox mode, you just can't shut me up. Doesn't necessarily mean the conversation will be good. But I don't know. I tend to go deep talk with a lot of people. We skip over the small talk and go straight to the big talk. Which is nice. Ish, I suppose. I don't know. What am I saying? Why am I talking about myself so much? We're told, says our treat, we're also told that he had never been interested, he said, when he lived in Rouen, in going to the theatre to see the actors from Paris. He did not know how to swim, or fence, or fire a pistol, and he was not able to explain to her one day a writing term she had encountered in a novel. Which makes him boring if you're really into those things, but I can sympathise with him. I dislike going to the movies or to the theatre, and I only do it rarely, mostly as an obligation to others, and mostly only if they are paying for my ticket, honestly. I'm not into athletics either. Different strokes, eh? Different people and different folks have strokes that are different from one another. Rather, it seems, continues our treat, that Charles is quite talkative and interested in people in the life of the countryside. His conversation consists of telling Emma, one by one, all the people he had met, the villages where he had been, the prescriptions he had written, which sounds a lot like the types of "here's how my day was" that my husband and I talk about when we get home. Some people would likely think it's boring, but sometimes we can analyse an event from one of our days for 10 or 15 minutes. However, we both seem to enjoy it and the interest is mutual. The only problem I see with Charles is that he doesn't really reciprocate an interest in her, or at least we're not told that he solicits the same type of information from her, and satisfied with himself, he would eat the remains of the beef hash with onions, cut the rind off his cheese, munch an apple, empty his carafe, then go to bed, sleep on his back and snore. Charles is happy with his simple life and seems content, which, more power to him. I wish I felt that level of contentedness in my satisfaction with life quotient. I think I fall much closer to Emma, as I'm always a bit frustrated with the way things are, though this is all directed at time and work and health concerns, constraints, rather than at my husband, whom I adore. Unfortunately for Emma, she misunderstands love so badly and seems to mistake fanciful notions of romance for actual affection that she thinks ardently wishing Charles would change is the way to engender in herself tender feelings for him. I'm thinking of that paragraph where she just recites poetry in the garden by moonlight and is then disappointed when he doesn't suddenly change. Not really the way to grow love, sadly. All in all, I think there are plenty of women who would have been pleased with Charles as a mate, as he seemed pleasant, indulgent, and doting. His first wife seemed happy with him, although she seemed to have some deficiencies of her own, though don't we all. I think Emma would have been happier with someone more charismatic and stereotypically masculine, an extroverted and stylish type, although I do think, based on the way she is approaching things and on the reality of married life, that any real person would have inevitably disappointed her in some way. It just may have been easier for her to handle if they were a dapper, dashing fellow as well. Simply Productive, I like this comment. I think she would have loved Newman from the last book, but she has Charles, so ... yeah, I think you might be right. Where's old Newman when you need him? Charles. What do we think of Charles? Like, I feel like the narrator dislikes him. Almost like the narrator wants us to dislike Charles. But at the same time, I'm like, I kind of feel bad for him. Like, a lot of the stuff that's happened in his life has been a lot out of his control and maybe not quite his fault. mismatch. You know, why do they always mismatch, these married couples? How hard is it? Charlotte says, I checked lit charts and was surprised to see their lovemaking becomes a boring habit. I didn't remember reading that, so I went back to take a look. I think it was this sentence. Charles's outbursts became regular. He embraced her at certain fixed times. Just in case anyone else missed that euphemism. You know, that euphemism, when I read that line, actually did cross my mind. I'm like, is that mean what I thought it mean? But I always just kind of second-guess myself and think like, no, you've just got a dirty mind. Apparently not. The biggest ultra moment was for me, and yet, in accord with theories she believed right, she wanted to experience love with him. By moonlight in the garden, she recited all the passionate rhymes she knew by heart, and sang to him many melancholy adagios. But she found herself as calm after this as before, and Charles seemed no more amorous and no more moved. If she recited them convincingly and Charles was fooled, that paints a sad and kind of pitiful picture. If she was unconvincing, that's just awkward as hell. J Mama 8779 said, this is one big disaster. How do we get here? She straight up thinks this guy is awful. Yep. And what is she like? Wishful. Romantic. And disappointed, I suppose. Oh, man. Hemingway, why did you recommend this book? It's like, it's good writing. And even the plot is coming together in a sort of interesting way, but... they're all these books are just about relationships. and this is just an awkward one, really, more than anything. Like, of all the books we've read, this is the one where this relationship just makes me feel awkward and uncomfortable for these two. Like, they've just done some silly mistake, and you just want to go, oh, man, let's do that. Starfall 15 says, ambition and satisfaction, the two pillars of this marriage. She constantly wants more of life. At home, she was happy to go to the convent. Then she was happy to be back home. Then it was marriage. Whomever she married, she would have been unsatisfied. She is unsatisfied with her present. She's always looking for the future. At least Flaubert had Emma be good at her interests and had her pursue several interests. She even did the finances of her husband. She is trying, but her options aren't many for her time, especially if her husband doesn't share his her ambitions. She can't change her position in life without his help and modicum of ambition. While Charles is quite satisfied with his fate, never questioned his mother's decisions, and feels like he has hit the jackpot by choosing Emma, that's it for him. He made one decision in life, and he is set for life, although technically it was his father-in-law who made it. I liked the passage describing her surroundings on her walk back home. It reflected the prison she felt she is being confined in the avenue a green light dimmed by the leaves lighted the short moss that crackled softly beneath her feet. The sun was setting, the sky showed red between the branches and the trunks of the trees uniform and planted in a straight line, seemed a brown colonnade standing out against a background of gold. A fear took hold of her. She called it Jali and hurriedly returned to Tostes by the high road, threw herself into an armchair, and for the rest of the evening did not speak. She is always looking for the future, I think is the perfect description of her, says Simply Productive. Where am I? What am I doing? Oh, there's a lot of conversation on this one. I'll go one more comment for you guys. And then we'll keep reading. TA131901 says, I had to laugh at the description of the relationship between Alden, Madame Bovary, and Emma. Mother-in-law, conflicts are eternal. Mother-in-law, daughter-in-law, conflicts are eternal. But the main sense I had while reading this chapter is one of Emma's boredom, the boredom of the country life in that time period. Had Emma loved Charles in the dramatic way that she wanted, maybe she would have been content for a while, at least. When I met my husband, he was living in a backwater small town, and I never minded visiting him there. We'd always find something to do, and I have very fond memories of that place, but I was into my husband. But here's Emma, bored in her marriage, nothing to do at home. The servant does all the heavy lifting, I presume, like the hands on cooking and cleaning. Travelling anywhere is time-consuming and expensive. No TV, no internet, no phone to numb herself. Even books and publications are fairly minimal. A person with self-discipline and more realistic expectations of marriage could probably keep busy with the piano and drawing and whatnot, but someone like Emma... you feel bad for her. What would you even do to pass the time? She's in isolation. Oh, ahead of her time. All right. That's the conversation of the book so far. Done. What? Now I'm going to continue reading the book, which goes exactly like this, because that's how reading works. The Chateau, a modern building in Italian style. Chapter 8, by the way. The Chateau, a modern building in Italian style, with two projecting wings and three flights of steps, lay at the foot of an immense green sward on which some cows were grazing among groups of large trees set out at regular intervals, while large beds of arbutus, rhododendron, syringas, and guelder roses bulged out of their irregular clusters of green along the curve of the gravel path. The river flowed under a bridge. Through the mist one could distinguish buildings with thatched roofs scattered over the field, bordered by two gently sloping, well-timbered hillocks. And in the background, amid the trees, rose in two parallel lines the coach houses and stables, all that was left of the ruined old chateau. Charles's dog cart pulled up before the middle flight of steps. Servants appeared. The Marquis came forward and, offering his arm to the doctor's wife, conducted her to the vestibule. It was paved with marble slabs, was very lofty, and the sound of footsteps and that of voices re-echoed through it as in a church. Opposite rose a straight staircase, and on the left a gallery overlooking the garden bed to the billiard room, through whose door one could hear the click of the ivory balls. As she crossed it to go to the drawing room, Emma saw standing round the table men with grave faces, their chins resting on high cravats. They all wore orders and smiled silently as they made their strokes. On the dark wainscoting of the walls, large gold frames bore at the bottom names written in black letters. She read, Jean Antoine d'Andevilliers de Yverville, Count de la Vaubyessard and Baron de la Fresnay, killed at the Battle of Coutres on the 20th of October, 1587. And on another, Jean Antoine Henry Guy de Andevilliers de la Vaubyessard, Admiral of France and Chevalier of the Order of St. Michael, wounded at the Battle of the Hooge St. Vaast on the 29th of May, 1692, died at Vaubyessard on the 23rd of January, 1693. One could hardly make out those that followed, for the light of the lamps lowered over the green cloth threw a dim shadow round the room. Burnishing the horizontal pictures, it broke up against these in delicate lines where there were cracks in the varnish, and from all these great black squares framed in with gold stood out here and there some lighter portion of the painting, a pale brow, two eyes that looked at you, perukes flowing over and powdering red-coated shoulders. On the buckle of the garter above a well-rounded calf. The Marquise opened the drawing-room door. One of the ladies, the Marchioness herself, came to meet Emma. She made her sit down by her on an ottoman and began talking to her as amicably as if she had known her a long time. She was a woman of about 40, with fine shoulders, a hooked nose, a drawling voice, and on this evening she wore over her brown hair a simple jaupeur fichu that fell in a point at the back. A fair young woman sat in a high-backed chair in a corner, and gentlemen with flowers in their buttonholes were talking to ladies round the fire. At 7, dinner was served. The men who were in the majority sat down at the first table in the vestibule, the ladies at the second in the dining room with the Marquise and Marchioness. Emma, on entering, felt herself wrapped round by the warm air and a blending of the perfume of flowers and of the fine linen, of the fumes in the viands and the odour of the truffles. The silver dish covers reflected the lighted wax candles in a row the whole length of the table, and in the large bordered plates, each napkin arranged after the fashion of a bishop's mitre, held between its two gaping folds a small oval-shaped roll. The red claws of lobsters hung over the dishes. Rich fruit in open baskets was piled up on moss. There were quails in the plumage, smoke was rising, and in silk stockings, knee breeches, white cravat, and frilled shirt, the steward, grave as a judge, offering ready-carved dishes between the shoulders of the guests, with a touch of the spoon, gave you the piece chosen. On the large stove of porcelain, inlaid with copper baguettes, the statue of a woman draped to the chin gazed motionless on the room full of life. Madame Bovary noticed that many ladies had not put their gloves in their glasses, but at the upper end of the table, alone, or amongst all these women, bent over his full plate and his napkin tied round his neck like a child, an old man sat eating, letting drops of gravy drip from his mouth. His eyes were bloodshot, and he wore a little queue tied with black ribbon. He was the Marquis's father-in-law, the old Duke de La Verdière, once on a time favourite of the Count d'Artois, in the days of the vaudeville hunting parties at the Marquise de Conflans, and had been, it was said, the lover of Queen Marie Antoinette, between Monsieur de Coligny and Monsieur de Lauzun. He had lived a life of noisy debauch, full of duels, bets, elopements. He had squandered his fortune and frightened all his family. A servant behind his chair named aloud to him in his ear the dishes that he pointed to, stammering, and constantly Emma's eyes turned involuntarily to this old man with hanging lips as to something extraordinary. He had lived at court and slept in the bed of queens. Iced champagne was poured out. Emma shivered all over as she felt it cold in her mouth. She had never seen pomegranates nor tasted pineapples. The powdered sugar even seemed to her whiter and finer than elsewhere. The ladies afterwards went to their rooms to prepare for the ball. Emma made her toilet with the fastidious care of an actress on her debut. She did her hair according to the directions of the hairdresser and put on the barège dress spread out upon the bed. Charles's trousers were tight across the belly. "My trouser straps will be rather awkward for dancing," he said. "Dancing?" repeated Emma. "Yes." "Why, you must be mad. They would make fun of you. Keep your balance. Besides, it is more becoming for a doctor," she added. Charles was silent. He walked up and down, waiting for Emma to finish dressing. He saw her from behind, in the glass between two lights. Her black eyes seemed blacker than ever. Her hair, undulating towards the ears, shone with a blue lustre. A rose in her chignon trembled on its mobile stalk, with artificial dewdrops on the tip of the leaves. She wore a gown of pale saffron, trimmed with three bouquets of pompon roses mixed with green. Charles came and kissed her on the shoulder. "Let me alone," she said. You are tumbling me. One could hear the flourish of the violin and the notes of a horn. She went downstairs, restraining herself from running. Dancing had begun. Guests were arriving. There was some crushing. She sat down on a form near the door. The quadrille over, the door was occupied by groups of men standing up and talking, and servants in livery bearing large trays. Along the side of seated women, painted fans was fluttering, bouquets half-hid smiling faces, and gold-stoppered scent bottles were turned in partly closed hands, whose white gloves outlined the nails and tightened on the flesh at the wrists. Lace trimmings, diamond brooches, medallion bracelets trembled on bodices, gleamed on breasts, clinked on bare arms. The hair, well smoothed over at the temples and knotted at the nape, bore crowns or bunches or sprays of mitosotis, jasmine, pomegranate blossoms, ears of corn, and corn flowers. Calmly seated in their places, mothers with forbidding countenances were wearing red turbans. Emma's heart beat rather faster when her partner, holding her by the tips of the fingers, she took her place in a line with the dancers and waited for the first note to start. But her emotion soon vanished, and swaying to the rhythm of the orchestra, she glided forward with slight movements of the neck. A smile rose to her lips at certain delicate phrases of the violin that sometimes played alone while the other instruments were silent. One could hear the clear clink of the louis d'or that were being thrown down upon the card tables in the next room. Then all struck again. The cornet a piston uttered its sonorous note. Feet marked time, skirts swelled and rustled, hands touched and parted, the same eyes falling before you met yours again. A few men, some 15 or so, or 25 to 40, scattered here and there among the dancers, or talking at the doorways, distinguished themselves from the crowd by a certain air of breeding, whatever their differences in age, dress, or face. Their clothes, better made, seemed of finer cloth, and their hair, brought forward in curls towards the temples, glossy with their delicate pomades. They had the complexion of wealth, that clear complexion that is heightened by the pallor of porcelain, the shimmer of satin, the veneer of old furniture, and that an ordered regimen of exquisite nurture maintains at its best. The necks moved easily in their low cravats. Their long whiskers fell over their turned-down collars. They wiped their lips upon handkerchiefs with embroidered initials that gave forth a subtle perfume. Those who were beginning to grow old had an air of youth, while there was something mature in the faces of the young. In their unconcerned looks was the calm of passions daily satiated, and through all their gentleness of manner pierced that peculiar brutality, the result of a command of half-easy things in which force is exercised and vanity amused, the management of thoroughbred horses and the society of loose women. A few steps from Emma, a gentleman in a blue coat was talking of Italy with a pale young woman wearing a parure of pearls. They were praising the breadth of the columns of St. Peter's, Tivoli, Vesuvius, Castlemaire, and Cassines, the roses of Genoa, at the Colosseum by moonlight. With her other ear, Emma was listening to a conversation full of words she did not understand. A circle gathered round a very young man who the week before had beaten Miss Arabella and Romulus and won 2,000 Louis jumping a ditch in England. One complained that his racehorses were growing fat, another of the printer's errors that had disfigured the name of his horse. The atmosphere of the ball was heavy, the lamps were growing dim. Guests were flocking to the billiard room. A servant got up on a chair and broke the window panes. At the crash of the glass, Madame Bovary turned her head and saw in the garden the faces of peasants pressed against the window looking in at them. Then the memory of the Berteaux came back to her. She saw the farm again, the muddy pond, her father in a blouse under the apple trees, and she saw herself again as formerly, skimming with her finger the cream off the milk pans in the dairy. But in the refulgence of the present hour, her past life, so distinct until then, faded away completely, and she almost doubted having lived it. She was there, beyond the ball, was only shadow overspreading all the rest. She was just eating a maraschino ice that she had held with her left hand in a silver gilt cup, her eyes half closed, and the spoon between her teeth. A lady near her dropped her fan. A gentleman was passing. "Would you be so good," said the lady, "as to pick up my fan that has fallen behind the sofa?" The gentleman bowed, and as he moved to stretch out his arm, Emma saw the hand of a young woman throw something white, folded in a triangle, into his hat. The gentleman picked up the fan, offered it to the lady respectfully. Then she thanked him with an inclination of the head and began smelling her bouquet. After supper, where were plenty of Spanish and Rhine wines, soups a la bisque and au lait d'amandes, milk with almond milk, puddings a la Trafalgar, and all sorts of cold meats with jellies that trembled in the dishes, the carriages one after the other began to drive off, raising the corners of the muslin curtain. One could see the light of their lanterns glimmering through the darkness. The seats began to empty. Some card players were still left. The musicians were cooling the tips of their fingers with their tongues. Charles was half asleep, his back propped against a door. At 3 o'clock the cotillion began. Emma did not know how to waltz. Everyone was waltzing, Mademoiselle d'Andeville's herself and the Marquise. Only the guests staying at the castle were still there, about a dozen persons. One of the waltzers, however, who was familiarly called Viscount, and whose low-cut waistcoat seemed moulded to his chest, came a second time to ask Madame Bovary to dance, assuring her that he would guide her and that she would get it through it very well. They began slowly, then went more rapidly. They turned all around them, was turning the lamps, the furniture, the wainscoting, the floor like a disc on a pivot. On passing near the doors, the bottom of Emma's dress caught against his trousers. Their legs commingled. He looked down at her. She raised her eyes to his. A torpor seized her. She stopped. They started again, and with a more rapid movement, the Viscount, dragging her along, disappeared with her to the end of the gallery, where, panting, she almost fell, and for a moment rested her head upon his breast. And then, still turning, but more slowly, he guided her back to her seat. She leaned back against the wall and covered her eyes with her hands. She was open When she opened them again, in the middle of the drawing room, three waltzers were kneeling before a lady sitting on a stool. She chose the Viscount, and the violin struck up once more. Everyone looked at them. They passed and repassed. She was rigid in body, her chin bent down, and he, always in the same pose, the figure curved, his elbow rounded, his chin thrown forward. The woman knew how to waltz. They kept up a long time and tried out all the others. Tired out all the others. Then they talked a few moments longer, and after the good nights, or rather good mornings, the guests of the chateau retired to bed. Charles dragged himself up by the balusters. His knees were going up into his body. He had spent 5 consecutive hours standing bolt upright at the card table, watching them play, whilst without understanding anything about it, and it was with a deep sigh of relief that he pulled off his boots. Emma threw a shawl over her shoulders, opened the window, and leaned out. The night was dark. Some drops of rain were falling. She breathed in the damp wind that refreshed her eyelids. The music of the ball was still murmuring in her ears, and she tried to keep herself awake in order to prolong the illusion of this luxurious life that she would soon have to give up. Day began to break. She looked long at the windows of the chateau, trying to guess which were the rooms of all those she had noticed the evening before. She would fain have known their lives, have penetrated, blended with them, but she was shivering with cold. She understood and cowered down between the sheets against Charles, who was asleep. There were a great many people to luncheon. The repast lasted 10 minutes. No liquors were served, which astonished the doctor. Next, Mademoiselle d'Andeville collected some pieces of roll in a small basket to take them to the swans on the ornamental waters, and they went to talk in the hot houses where strange plants bristling with hairs rose in pyramids under hanging vases whence, as from overfilled nests of serpents, fell long green cords interlacing. The orangery, which was at the other end, led by a covered way to the outhouses of the chateau, the marquise, to amuse the young woman, took her to the stables. Above the basket-shaped racks, porcelain slabs bore the names of the horses in black letters. Each animal in its stall whisked its tail when anyone went near and said, "Chuk, chuk." The boards of the harness room shone like the flooring of a drawing room. The carriages, harnesses, was piled up in the middle against two twisted columns, and the bits, the whips, and the spurs and the curbs were ranged in a line all along the wall. Charles, meanwhile, went to ask a groom to put his horse to. The dog-cart was brought to the foot of the steps, and all the parcels being crammed in, the Bovarys paid their respects to the Marquis of Marchioness and set out again for Tostes. Emma watched the turning wheels in silence. Charles, on the extreme edge of the seat, held the reins with his two arms wide apart, and the little horse ambled along in the shafts that were too big for him. The loose reins hanging over his crupper were wet with foam, and the box fastened on behind the chaise gave great regular bumps against it. They were on the heights of Thibberville when suddenly some horsemen with cigars between their lips passed laughing. Emma thought she recognized the Viscount, turned back, and caught on the horizon only the movement of the heads rising and falling with the unequal cadence of the trot or gallop. A mile farther on they had to stop to mend with some string the traces that had broken. But Charles, giving a last look to the harness, saw something on the ground between his horse's legs, and he picked up a cigar case with a green silk border and blazoned in the center like the doctor of a carriage. "There are even 2 cigars in it," he said. "They'll do for this evening after dinner." "Why, do you smoke?" she asked. "Sometimes, when I get a chance." He put his find in his pocket and whipped up the nag. When they reached home, the dinner was not ready. Madame lost her temper. Nastasie answered rudely. "Leave the room," said Emma. "You are forgetting yourself. I give you warning." For dinner there was onion soup and a piece of veal with sorrel. Charles, seated opposite Emma, rubbed his hands gleefully. "How good is it to be home again?" Nastasie could be heard crying. He was rather fond of the poor girl. She had formerly, during the wearisome time of his widowhood, kept him company many an evening. She had been his first patient, his oldest acquaintance in the place. "Have you given her warning for good?" he asked at last. "Yes. Who is to prevent me?" she replied. Then they warned warmed themselves in the kitchen while their room was being made ready. Charles began to smoke. He smoked with lips protruding, spitting every moment, recoiling at every puff. "You'll make yourself ill," she said scornfully. He put down his cigar and ran to swallow a glass of cold water at the pump. Emma, seizing hold of the cigar case, threw it quickly to the back of the cupboard. The next day was a long one. She walked about her little garden, up and down the same walks, stopping before the beds, before the espalier, before the plaster curate, looking with amazement at all these things at once on a time that she knew so well. How far off the ball seemed already. What was it that thus set so far asunder the morning of the day before yesterday and the evening of today? Her journey to Vaubyessard had made a hole in her life, like one of those great crevices that a storm will sometimes make in one night in mountains. Still, she was resigned. She devoutly put away in her drawers her beautiful dress, down to the satin shoes, whose soles were yellowed with the slippery wax of the dancing floor. Her heart was like these. It, in its friction against wealth, something had come over it that could not be effaced. The memory of this ball then became an occupation for Emma. Whenever the Wednesday came around, she said to herself as she woke, "Ah, I was there a week, a fortnight, 3 weeks ago." And little by little the faces grew confused in her remembrance. She forgot the tune of the quadrilles. She no longer saw the liveries and appointments so distinctly. Some details escaped her, but the regret remained with her. All right, there we go, another chapter down. Thank you very much for listening to that one. Bit of a longie. I'll see you tomorrow.